Ron and Anian.
It's not over till it's over. You don't know until the car is fixed if that's all it is.
Over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we decide it is.
The Car Doctor.
There's no access from the inside. I have to remove the tank to get to it.
Yeah, there is if you want to get a hole saw and cut a hole through the floor. But, you know, I don't think so.
Welcome to the radio home of Ron and Anian, the Car Doctor. Since 1991, this is where car owners the world over turn to for their definitive opinion on automotive repair. If your mechanic's giving you a busy signal, pick up the phone and call in. The garage doors are open.
But I am here to take your calls at 855-560-9900.
And now, here's Ronnie.
Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Leave them alone, he's rolling. I always wanted to say that line. Hello and welcome, Ron and Annie, the Car Doctor, at your service. Great movie, Tom. Thanks for the clip. You know, it's funny, today's open, right, is that. And Tom and I don't really commiserate on opens. I just kind of let him do his thing, and whatever he wants to do, he does, and I do my thing. And somehow the magic of this show just works. I wanted to talk about a 2013 Jeep Wrangler that we worked on this week that, you know, it's over when it's over. And this particular vehicle came in with a complaint of poor heat. The heat just wasn't getting hot enough. Rolled in the door. And it had a couple of things going on. The tire pressure light was on. The check engine light was on. The airbag light was on. And it had poor heat. Well, something I've incorporated into the repair process at the shop in the last, gosh, it's got to be 8 or 9 years now, is when we scan for codes, we scan everything. We want to look at every available module on the vehicle. We want to get a complete overall picture of health. Because really, you know, it's not secular. You don't want to be just down and single out just one particular component, because components work together and there can be similar problems created by, you know, more than one component. This Jeep had an airbag fault unrelated to anything we were working on, but at least we knew there was a fault registered in the airbag clock spring on the driver's side. Great. You know what? It's noted it down. The customer didn't want to fix it. That's okay. You know, the onus is off us. It's not about us anymore. It's, you know, here's your airbag. It probably needs a clock spring. Great. No problem. The check engine light had was caused by a P0128. A P0128 in diagnostic jargon is an indication that it's not a matter of engine temperature necessarily not being hot enough. It's also rate of rise. How fast does it warm up? So it can be a combination of either or. In the case of this Jeep, it would not maintain temperature. It saw lower than spec, and it did not see it get to the minimum mark in a fast enough period of time. So it was actually both, thinking about it. It had both ends of the spectrum, both ends of the possibility of the code to be caused, what trips the code to come on. So P0128, not a V6 Jeep. You know, we diagnosed it, and not uncommon, good coolant level. Everything seemed to be flowing correctly. If you let the vehicle idle, hood down, you could get good underhood temperature out of it. But then when you drove it, you saw it drop down to about 168 degrees, and you said, okay, let's start with a thermostat. Thermostat on this Jeep is a complete housing. It's a thermostat housing, gasket seal. They make it as a modular one-piece component. And we looked it up, got a piece out of Motorrad. The folks at Motorrad make an excellent thermostat for this vehicle. And, you know, put the Motorrad stat in, and sure enough, our engine temperature came up to normal. It did what it was supposed to do. Solved problem number one. TPMS light, it really wasn't there for that. It was low air in the tires. The customer didn't realize it was actually high on one side, low on the other. The tire pressures were all over the place. And you know what? Part of that problem is, as an aside to this repair, part of that problem is there's no place to get air in tires anymore. You know, you can't pull into your corner garage, corner gas station. Nobody's got an air pump out anymore. It doesn't seem to exist. So, you know, it seems like the federal government mandated where we should all be worried about tire pressures with tire pressure lights. And now we've got nowhere to go to get them. Tire pressure check. So just that's a whole nother thing. So we solved the one problem, the P0128, put a Motorrad thermostat in it, and, you know, good to go. Second problem was still it had no heat. And I had warned the customer of this. I said, you know, Michael, it's not maintaining engine heat. But one of the things I noticed is that when I move the blend door actuator, you turn the temperature knob, all that is an electrical servo control, you know, I don't hear the door clunking. I don't hear door movement. I don't hear like the blend door is actually doing anything. So, you know, diagnosed that too, got down, sat down with a scan tool, and it's kind of neat what you can do with a scan tool today. You know, it really gives you a lot of good, solid information. Got out my Autel MS-808 and or the MaxiSys, I think they call it, from Autel. And I was able to go into the body module and, you know, turn the temp control knob. So imagine this. If you look up the information, Autel gives you the ability, by virtue of the way they lay out the information, that I could go in. I went to HVAC is what it is, HVAC module. It's controlled by the body module. See how it gets overlapping and complicated? And I was able to look at desired blend door position, which read 58 because I had it about mid-range, but actual blend door position was reported as 0. I cranked it all the way up, and it said desired blend door position 100, actual position 0. It never moved. So I've either got a signal problem to the actuator itself. Think of the front door to your house. You want more fresh air. You open the door, the air comes in. You don't want any fresh air. You close the door, the air stays out. Same thing with a temperature blend door over a heater core. The door opens, more air can flow over the heater core, put more heat into the cabin. You want less heat. You close the door, no heat comes into the cabin. And it's controlled by a little electric servo on the side. Blend door, right? Or temp door, whichever way you want to, whatever term you want to use. So went down to the actuator, no easy task. Had to take out the knee bolster, the trans control module, move the air duct out of the way, and found the actuator and checked power and ground. Had it, had signal, had request, put a scope on the data line, had request. You got a bad actuator. Door moved okay. You always want to look at everything. Check the door itself. Does the door pivot? Does the front door to the house stick? Are the hinges rusty in a sense? And, you know, put an actuator in it, solve that problem. Self-calibrated. It had a self-calibrated. Chrysler's good about that. I give them credit for that. They make it so that you can do an easy recalibration, or all the Autel would do that as well. And it gave me the ability to go back and look. And then I got the Autel back out and sat there and, you know, cranked the knob and went, asking for 100 degrees, it went to 100. Asking for 50% of heat, it went to halfway, it went to the midway mark, 52. And it's nice. You can do that with a scan tool, and that's my point. You have the ability with scan tools, with certain tools now that have complete access or giving you, like original equipment manufacturer access, it gives you the ability to look and see information. It's not like the old days where we'd have to get out there and track points over a scope line and look to see did it move so many degrees or so many steps. In a way, technology has made life easier in the service bay for diagnosing if you're using a tool and using it properly. And the bottom line, thermostat, actuator, a little bit of coolant, and the vehicle was finally fixed. And it makes you say to yourself, where's bottom? Bottom's the bottom. Bottom is wherever it takes you. Bottom is whatever it's got to be to fix that vehicle. It's over when it's over. Because here's a vehicle, classic, right? Will a thermostat cause poor engine heat or low engine heat? Absolutely. Will a blend door actuator or a temp door actuator cause low engine heat? Absolutely. Which problem's bad? They're both bad. And I'm not saying this is every vehicle. I'm just saying, you know, it's tough on a repair shop, and I get why people ask. It's tough on a repair shop to estimate a course of action. What a repair shop is really obligated to do is they're obligated to estimate a diagnosis. You know what? We need an hour and a half of time. We need 2 hours of time. We need 15 minutes. We're not quite sure. Let's start with some preliminary information for an hour. That's really what a repair shop should be doing. You know, I know guys that are still poking and hoping. They're guessing. They're unplugging things. Does this work? Does that work? Did that make a change of state? That's not a diagnosis. And quite frankly, that's damaging not only to the customer, but it's also damaging to the repair shop because the shop isn't learning anything along the way. because auto repair is a braille method. You know, it's see it, touch it, feel it. You're learning things every day because what worked yesterday doesn't necessarily guarantee that it'll work tomorrow. When you're looking at a car, you're always learning. You're always getting an education, and you know, just a very, very important part of the process. So I guess your point, your takeaway from this is A, you know, bottom is bottom. Doesn't have to necessarily be just changing one part or, you know, having one problem. And, you know, it's also a case of you got to diagnose. You got to diagnose from the beginning and look at everything. And, you know, that'll solve it all for you. So here's a vehicle, airbag light, check engine light, TPMS light, and a blend door problem that wasn't even listed anywhere on the dashboard, if you want to think of it like that. And it still had a mechanical failure of the actuator, yet it didn't set a code. So just cars are getting complicated. Hello and welcome. I'm Ron Ananian and the Car Doctor here at 855-560-9900. Here to talk about your car, whatever it is. If you're new to us, thank you for joining us. And we're glad to be part of your automotive family. Hope we give you good enough education. Just a point, I want to point out that the folks at Goodyear Brakes are doing a Give Them a Break giveaway. That's right, Goodyear Brakes, goodyearbrakes.com. They're doing a, they'd like you, this isn't about Tom and I, this is about you. They'd like you to nominate a frontline essential worker who needs new brakes on their vehicle. Submit their story. Go on Facebook to tell us. Send us an email, ron@cardoctorshow.com, or just call in and submit them up here on air. We want to know who you think has been doing such a great job these past couple of months with the pandemic. The folks at Goodyear Brake want to put brakes on their car and help them out. So we want you to be aware of that, and by all means, give us a call, nominate them, get out to the Car Doctor Facebook page, however you want to do it. Let me pull over and take a pause for the cause. The Car Doctor will be back right after this.
That's right. If you call and we're not live, you can leave a message and we'll call you back to get you on the air with Ron. 855-560-9900. Speaking of Ron, here he is.
Hey, let's do some emails real quick. Let's go through the pile because the list is getting big. Bruce writes in, Ron, awesome show. Always learn something. What's the name of the paint you use on the hot rod's frame? Benjamin Moore Low Luster Alkaloid. We got a picture of it kicking around somewhere. As a matter of fact, there's a picture of it up on the Car Doctor Facebook page. And it's a DTM direct to metal type of paint. It's in a blue and silver can. We always buy the quart size cans, if I remember right. It's about, it's like 30, 35 bucks, something like that. And, you know, works really well. There's minimal surface prep. But keep in mind, Bruce and everybody else, the Benjamin Moore Low Luster Alkaloid, you know, it's not sold as a rust preventative. It's sold as a rust inhibitor. And, you know, the difference is somewhere along the way, somewhere down the line, yeah, that, you know, it might allow moisture in. It might break down over time. I've got to say that in the 11 years it's on the hot rod's 11 years old now. And, you know, actually 10 years old. We finished it in 11. It really hasn't, but, you know, it doesn't go out in all kinds of crazy weather. However, I will say this. On the plow truck and all the plow trucks, and I've been using it on plow trucks longer than I've been using it on hot rods, once I paint it, it stays there. And the nice thing about the Benjamin Moore Low Luster Alkaloid paint is it'll stick to chicken feathers. So it just never seems to fall off. So good stuff. So you can take a look at that. Let's go over and let's go talk to, real quick, I'll come back to the email. Let's go talk to Brian in Long Island and see what's going on here. Brian, welcome to the Car Doctor, sir. How can I help?
Hey, how you doing?
Good, sir.
Hey, I got a 1962 Caddy.
Okay.
I let it sit around the garage for, you know, maybe a couple of months, and then I go to start it. And, you know, I try, well, it's got the fuel pump that it won't kick in right away.
Right.
So I just keep cranking until the oil light goes off. Is that the best way to do it on a dry start like that?
I think so. I mean, short of, you know, trying to prime the pump and go through all that, I don't think it's going to matter at this point. There is a certain amount of cling factor to oil. I would think probably the bigger concern I'd have is, being as that it's an older vehicle, you know, it's hard finding correct oil for that. So make sure you're using, you know, I'll call it classic car oil.
I put regular oil. The other classic car, does that have zinc in it?
Well, what I would do is, here's what I want you to do. Go out to the internet. Go to Castrol.com. They actually manufacture a wide. I was just out there this week. They actually manufacture a wide variety of viscosities. and they actually list the ones that are classic, we'll call it classic car rated with zinc. And you'll find that information there. But yeah, you know, zinc was an important additive to oil back to us when we had cars back in that generation and that in that modality. I think that's probably more important than, you know, just as important as cranking it over on that dry start. Now, you could also, you know, you could also set yourself up, get a little plastic beaker, fill it with some fuel, take the air cleaner lid off. You know where the vent tube is in the top of the carburetor?
Right.
You could fill the bowl with a little bit of fuel and then start it.
I was doing that. I would take a little gas, put it in the carburetor so it would kick right over.
Right.
But then it would tick like hell a lot. So then I just did it without that and let the gas just build up into it because it would take, you know, a little cranking before it kicked on.
Okay.
And then the oil light would go off. So I thought maybe that was a better way of doing it.
Yeah, no. Oh, that's a fine way. I thought you wanted it to get it to start faster, but no, that's a fine way. You know, Brian, cars are a lot like little kids. If you listen to them long enough, they'll tell you where it hurts, and you just have to do what they say. You know, it's
not hurting. It just keep cranking it when it's not starting. Well, until the oil light goes off.
How long are you cranking it? 15 seconds.
It's probably probably 30 seconds or a little longer, maybe, before it, you know, could start. Because it's got that fuel pump in there. You know, it's a manual.
Mechanical.
Works off the engine.
Yeah, it's a mechanical pump. You ought to time it. 30 seconds sounds like a long time. You know, 30 seconds sounds like a long time. I would want to see it start sooner than that. And, you know, the other thing is, if you're using a good quality oil, and it's got the right additives in it. Here, we're back to that Castrol conversation, right? If you're using a good quality oil that's rated for the vehicle, then it's going to come back to oil has a cling factor. You know, oil does a lot more than we think and realize, and the engineers do a lot more to it to make it do what it's supposed to do. But if it's the right stuff for the vehicle, it will have a cling factor. It leaves a coating on the metal parts down at a microscopic level. And, you know, you'll be okay, but I wouldn't use a modern-day oil in an older engine because it may not have the right additives in it rated for that particular component. So
I used a Rotella for the diesels because that had the zinc in it.
Right, the 1540 is what
you need zinc.
Well, now, is that the right viscosity?
It was the right viscosity, I think.
Right,
I'm not sure. Yeah. But you're saying go to Castro.
Yeah, go to Castro.
Go to their website, and they'll have a oil for it.
Right, Castrol, Castrol.com, or just Google it. And, you know, they've got a listing of viscosities, and they've got enough reading material there about oil and types of oil and how to pick an oil. They do a lot of wonderful things on that website. It'll, you know, take a cup of coffee, and you'll be there a while. So, you know, just really good stuff. So, Castrol.com, very, very important. Appreciate the call, Brian. Enjoy your 62 Caddy. And let's see, you probably get out a couple of more times before the snow flies, and make sure you cruise with it, and, you know, you'll be good. So, thanks for the call, Brian. I appreciate it. I'm Ron Ananian, the Car Doctor. I'll be back right after this. Car Doctor here at 855-560-9900. Tom, you there? Testing. Calling Tom. Tom, you have to be there somewhere. He might be.
No, I left.
Yeah. Where would you go? So.
Any place but here, because it'd be more fun.
Yeah, well, I understand that. I had a question for you, but I forgot what it was. Is that important?
Probably not.
Yeah. Okay. So, things good on your end?
Everything's fine. You know, I was just thinking, you know, you had that email before from a listener who said, you know, only medical professionals are frontline employees for this Goodyear contest. And boy, there's a lot of frontline employees out there, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, actually what she was saying was she was saying that, you know, we should be clear. And as I expressed, you know, the Goodyear break, give them a break giveaway is frontline workers. But we define, you and I define frontline workers as essential workers. We think anybody, you know, grocery store, gasoline clerk, delivery people, police, fire, obviously, the medical people. You know, we think the
people who picked up your trash.
Yeah, you know what? It's Goodyear Breaks. Goodyearbreaks.com is trying to recognize the efforts of everybody. And you know what? It's not a bad deal. They're willing to give somebody breaks for their vehicle. And, you know, we just got to, what you have to do after the show is, and I'm going to lay this at your doorstep, is if you put a post up on our Facebook page,
yep,
and let them reply underneath it, you can pin it to the top, I think, so that it'll stay there all the time. And, yep, you know, just I'll send you the email with the official wording. And, yep, you know, let's see what we get. And we'll do that giveaway over the next couple of weeks. It'll be 2 or 3 weeks before we do it. So, but.
And, you know, I think this is great. I just absolutely think it's great.
I think it is great. And it's, you know what? It's a way to elevate people. And I think people right now need some elevation. I think the world is kind of beaten on us. And, you know, it's always good to hear success stories. And I think this could be one of them. So, but I'll leave it with you. Hey, you know who we have coming up next week, Tom? I haven't told you this, but you know, I reached out and we're gonna have Paul Eisenstein on again next week.
Excellent.
So
I like Paul.
Yeah, Paul's a good guy, and we're gonna be talking about. It's an interesting conversation. We're gonna be talking about how, and I've already had the conversation, part of the conversation with him, but now I have to do him with it here because, you know, you can't just ask Paul, hey, do you want to come on? You ask Paul, do you want to come on? He says, what do you want to talk about? And then you actually talk about it. You know, it's never that
simple.
Funny
how that works.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, he's got some good insight on how the coming electrification process is going to change the face of the automotive industry and the frontline workers there, you know, the assembly line workers and, you know, the changes that are coming for that. So the listeners don't want to miss that next week. Paul Eisenstein will be with us. And what makes me think about that is I have an email in front of me from Herb, Mr. Cooper. He's a longtime listener. And he writes and he says, Ron, I don't hear anything mentioned regarding the California executive order. But I want to point out a few decades ago, California instituted a very aggressive schedule for moving to low emissions. Right. Well, and, you know, California does need to change their emissions or do something. If somebody was telling me, and I think I talked about this not too long ago, in that when the pandemic first hit, that within, was it 3 weeks or 4 weeks, something like that, where this person lived, they could never see L.A., and after 4 weeks or whatever the time period was, a very short period of time of not driving, they could see downtown L.A. clear as a bell because, you know, the air had cleared up and cleaned up so well. So California does have the need for emissions. Mr. Cooper goes on to write, at the time, nobody knew how to do that, but the car companies figured it out and wouldn't have done so without the law. I don't know if they didn't know how to do it. I think they were trying to balance cost-effective and technology. Yes, electric cars are different, he continues to write, but 15 years is really a very long time as far as technology goes. It is, and I get it that we want to, you know, give us a point to stretch to, but I'm just questioning how. And I don't think it can just fall, and this is my contention. I don't think the electrification of California and the other states as they go through this, where it's only going to be electric cars for sale, no more internal combustion engines, is the infrastructure behind it. And then how will that be implemented? How will you, oh, for example, the Waldwick train station is 2 blocks from the shop. Will you electrify all those parking stalls? There's got to be parking for 200 cars. Will every train parking lot, you know, have a grid put in to electrify it? And who's going to pay for that? The taxpayers, the utility companies, the people renting the stalls. And then there's an apartment complex down the street from the shop that has parking for maybe 75 cars. They just built it, as a matter of fact, within the last 2 years. How will you electrify that parking lot? And at what cost? And will you have to rip up that parking lot? Because all those people living in townhouses and condos and apartments there, they can't run an extension cord out. They have no plug-in. They have no garage. And that's what I'm talking about. That, to me, is the bigger concern, or a very big concern. And as Mr. Cooper closes out, as far as the economic impact, computers completely changed our economy over a period of about 20 years. Yeah, they did. And the electric car is going to continue to change our technology. And listen, I'm not saying it shouldn't happen. I'm not saying it can happen. I just hope they're thinking about it and trying to implement it a little bit better than just, you know, boom, you have to do this. I hope somebody's thinking. And personally, what I see sometimes in California is I don't think a lot of people are thinking. I just don't see common sense. But, you know.
You know, you mentioned L.A. By the end of April, I had to go to a transmitter site I have in Queens, and you come down the BQE, which is on the east side of New York City, and you come around this curve in Brooklyn, and you take a look, and it's like, wow. All of a sudden, I could see detail in the buildings in Manhattan, and I could not have seen that before.
Right.
That's how clean the air got in about a month.
Right.
And, you know, coming down the hill in New Jersey on Route 17, where you can, all of a sudden, you see the skyline of New York City, there's no more haze over it.
Right.
So for the big cities, we need it, but, I mean, you're right. How do we implement it and make it work?
How do you implement it and make it work? And you know what? I would prefer, to me, they're putting the cart before the horse. Let's implement the technology. Let's implement how we will charge it. And then everybody will go out and buy it. Right? Instead of in 2035 in California, boom, that's it. Okay? No more gas engines. A, you're going to raise the price of the internal combustion engine. It's going to be more valuable. And then you're going to put pressure on how will the gas stations survive? So you've got to get rid of them. And you're going to start this snowboard effect of forcing change. You know, one thing I've learned, you know, there's an old story of wisdom about how the sun and the wind had an argument one day. And the wind was very boastful. The wind said, you know, I can get people to do anything I want them to do. And the sun said, well, yeah, but so can I. And they had this contest back and forth. And the wind said, watch this. I bet I can get this guy walking to take his coat off. And they both looked down and there was somebody walking along the path. And the wind blew hard as it could. And the harder the wind blew, the tighter the person grabbed their jacket. And I realize we're off the subject of cars here, but there's a little wisdom from the car doctor. And it didn't work. The sun said, now watch what I do. And the sun didn't do anything. The sun just shone brightly and it got warm. And in time, the man took off his coat and the wind looked at the sun and said, hey, how'd you do that? And he said, sometimes the sun told the wind, you know what? Sometimes brute force isn't the answer. A soft, gentle approach makes people do what they need to do because they realize that it's necessary in order to survive. I think if you applied electric car technology in that manner, I think if you made charging stations, if you showed the gas companies, hey, you know, this is where your niche is now going to be and you can help us produce electricity. Maybe I'm dreaming, but you know what? To me, that makes the most sense. Let's pull over and take a pause. 855-560-9900. Ron and Annie and the Car Doctor coming back right after this. Welcome back. Ron and Annie, the Car Doctor. Let's get over to Guy in Jersey, 16 Toyota Corolla. Guy, welcome to the Car Doctor. How can I help?
How you doing, Ron? Long time listener. Great, great show. Love your show.
Thank you, sir.
I have a question. I have a 2016 Toyota Corolla. It has disc in the front, drum in the back.
Okay.
I know it only has roughly about 20,000 miles on it, so I hardly use it.
Right.
But the issue that I'm having, Ron, is that when I step on the brake slowly, only slowly, I feel like a little thump and then it stops. Doesn't always do it. Now, I made a test where the car was actually parked, running, not moving, and it still does it. But it doesn't do it all the time. It does it most of the time. What could that be?
Okay. Front of the car, back of the car?
Excuse me?
From the front of the car or the back of the car?
It's hard to tell. All I do is feel it in the brake pedal.
Okay. So if you feel it in the brake pedal, are you feeling Are you feeling slop in the linkage or something in the master cylinder bore? I mean, listen, it doesn't seem to be affecting the operation, but obviously we're concerned because we're concerned because it's brakes. Do this: pull up on the parking brake. Do you ever use the parking brake?
Never.
Okay.
Never.
Pull up on the parking brake. Make sure the parking brake holds.
Okay.
You know, park on a little bit of an incline, pull up on the parking brake, put it in neutral. Does the car roll? No, good. You know, the parking brake is working. The rear brakes are locked on. Step on the brake. Do you still feel it? If you still feel it, it's not in the rears. I'm just trying to eliminate things. All right?
Right.
Okay? It's not in the rears because the rear shoes are already out. If you can't duplicate the noise ever with the parking brake on,
right,
and you know, maybe you feel it in your foot. Is it the shoe dragging itself over the backing plate in the rear of the vehicle? Maybe the shoes need to be lubricated against the backing plate where they pivot.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if the sensation is still there, then I would get under the dash, and I would take a look at all the linkage, the clevis pin, and the crossbar where it comes out, going to the push rod, going to the master, going to the booster, to make sure that you know nothing is loose, worn, falling out. And dangerous.
Right.
Okay.
This basically just started about a week and a half ago, Ron.
Okay.
I mean, the car, it doesn't sway. There's no lights on the dash or nothing.
Right. Well, that's why I say this could just be a straight up mechanical failure of some type. Could be something rubbing. It could be a wiring harness fell down and it's laying against the linkage rod. Until you get under the dash and look, or until you start to eliminate front or back, you're just not going to know. So do that with the parking brake, and if it still does it, give me a call. We'll brainstorm again together. I appreciate the call, Guy. Thank you. Liz in Missouri, 88 Nissan pickup truck, loss of power. Liz, how can I help?
I was going up the hill the other day, and it's a manual transmission.
Right.
And I was going up the hill the other day, and I lost power, and I'm like, so I downshifted, and it still was, you know, kind of spitting and stuff. And, you know, I finally got, you know, after I topped the hill, I finally got it to, you know, speed up, but it still has a loss of power. And a friend came over, and we checked the spark plugs, we checked the spark plug wires. The number one cylinder spark plug was a little, you know, dirty.
Fouled. Right, fouled.
And,
okay.
Yeah, a little fouled.
Right.
And, but we still had firing, and the coil had been replaced before because we had a similar problem, you know, with it, you know, acting up, not running right.
Right.
And that solved it at the time. But now we've got a problem again, and we don't know if it's maybe the power transmitter or if it's down in the distributor, maybe that crank tilt sensor.
Right.
Or
I'll tell you what, Liz, don't go away. Let me pull over, take a pause. I don't want to rush this. I'll come back. I'll give you some good info. Make sure you have a pencil and paper ready. I'm Ron Anani and the Car Doctor. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. Ron Anani and the Car Doctor at your service at 855-560-9900. Liz, you're still there?
Yes.
Okay, so, you know, there's a lot we could talk about. This is an 88, right? 88, 98, 2008, 2000, 32 years old. So there's a few things that could be wrong here. So let's just cover the basics in the time we've got. You know, V6 or four-cylinder?
Four-cylinder.
So you've got one spark plug that I guess we'll use the technical term schmutzy. It's kind of like got crud forming on the one end. So before we go anywhere and spend any money, can we do a compression test? Do you have the ability? Does your friend have any tools that he could just do?
Yes, he does, and he may be back today or tomorrow because he didn't have it with him.
Okay.
So he's going to bring it back and do a compression test.
Right. So let's do a compression test. And, you know, I could give you the number. I could tell you, and the number I recall is being quite high. I typically used to see those back in the day. Compression was around 180 pounds or higher. But what I'm looking for is more uniformity. If they were all 160, I wouldn't be upset. If three of them were 150 and one of them is 100, yeah, that's a concern, if you get my point. You know, I'm looking for uniformity.
Yes.
Now, if they're all 100, that's an issue too. So I would say we want to accept minimum compression of 150 PSI, but I would expect better. But I'm looking for them to all be within, you know, 5-10% of each other, 5-8% of each other. Okay, so let's look at compression. Could we have a restricted exhaust? Could something be breaking up muffler, catalytic converter? Could something be causing an exhaust restriction? Maybe your friend's got a vacuum gauge, and he can look at manifold vacuum. Manifold vacuum on any engine. You know, I always try to teach everybody, unless I'm being specific about general mechanical laws. You know, manifold vacuum at idle on an older vehicle like that, you're going to see between 16 and 18 inches of vacuum at idle. As you accelerate down the road, it'll dip as you put your foot into it. It'll go down to 10, 11 inches of vacuum, 8 inches of vacuum. But as you're cruising down the highway trying to make the hill, it'll go back up to 16, 18, and maybe higher. As you put your foot into it further, it'll drop. So just maybe do a vacuum test, all right? Last, spark timing. Did timing change? And then also you're looking at ignition. How does the distributor cap look? How does the rotor look? Do those things. Call me back next week. Don't just start changing parts. Let's talk about this. We can diagnose it through. I appreciate the call. I'm Ron Ananian, the Car Doctor, reminding you, good mechanics aren't expensive. They're priceless. See ya.